What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Deep State Radio. I am David Rothkopf, and I am your host, and I am at one of our many undisclosed locations at the moment. In Washington, D.C., we've got both Rosa Brooks of Georgetown University and Ed Luce of the Financial Times. In England, I think. I'm never sure.
Where? I am, in fact, in central London as we speak.
Corey Shockey in a tube stop in central London. And in our guest today, I think in Cambridge, Massachusetts, am I right?
Correct.
Is Professor Stephen Walt of the Harvard Kennedy School, author of the fantastic new book, The Hell of Good Intentions, which looks at America's policy elites at a moment where America's policy elites are under some degree of scrutiny. Fortunately, Steve, you know that when you come among all of us here at Deep State, we may deal with policy, but no one would call us elite.
I would.
Thank you.
And David, no one would say we have good intentions. We have sinister intentions, as is widely known.
Yeah. Okay. Well, again, the truth in advertising. So we're not elite and we have sinister intentions. Other than that, I thought it would be a great place to start for you to talk a little bit, Steve, about why you wrote this book right now.
Happy to do it. I started the book back in 2013, actually, after giving a talk at the State Department with the title, What's Wrong with U.S. Foreign Policy? And I was really trying to explore the question of why had all of the hopes and dreams of the 1990s, the optimism of that period, not borne fruit. If you recall how wonderful the world looked back then when democracy was spreading, we had pretty good relations with most of the other major powers. We were told we'd reached the end of history and that American-style liberal democracy was going to take hold just about everywhere. If you look to where we are today and all that's happened in the intervening 25 years or so, clearly something went wrong. And I argue in the book that the United States is not solely responsible for all of the negative things that have happened, but our fingerprints are over a lot of it. So I started working on this and had a nice draft of the book already in October 2016. Then we held an election, and I ended up having to spend another 18 months or so recasting it in light of Trump. Just one final thing. Trump, in fact, turns out to be bad for the world, bad for the country, but in some ways good for the book, because he is in such a case of my argument that there is a foreign policy elite. It's been running American foreign policy for a long time, and its handling of foreign policy the last quarter century has been pretty bad. He ran against that in 2016, but I think is discovering that changing the course of American foreign policy is a lot harder than he thought. He can change the style, but changing the substance is much more difficult.
If anybody can make foreign policy elites popular again, it's Donald Trump being against them.
I think that may be true.
So, guys, What's your reaction to the thesis of this, and do you have any questions for Steve?
So I have a question for Steve. The arc of the thesis, I think, is true. I like the way you and Patrick Porter both emphasize how broad the intellectual consensus is among the people who work on American foreign policy. And I think you're right that President Trump's visceral disbelief in the fundamental building blocks that those of us who constitute the foreign policy elites have long believed. I'm curious where you think he fits in the conversation about so-called realism. Because one of the things I noticed during the Obama administration was how many people who believed that American foreign policy should be unsentimental and should not overcommit to allies and, you know, some of the building blocks of the realist perspective. Many of those people were very hesitant to suggest that President Obama actually was carrying out in policy terms their intellectual viewpoint. And I'm not trying to say that President Trump is carrying out your intellectual viewpoint, but I would like you to try and place him in the firmament of how realists think about foreign policy. Where does he fit there?
That's a great question, and it actually relates to both Trump and Obama, so I'll try and deal with both. I think the view that most of my friendly realists would be is that he's the kind of guy who could give realism a bad name.
He's the kind of guy reality a bad name.
If only he believed in it. In any case, no, he's got an extremely sort of crude, almost Neanderthal view of it, that yes, it's states and states are competitive and states are always trying to do one another in some fashion. And I suppose you could argue that that's consistent with, again, the sort of crudest version of realism. But he misses all of the important parts. For example, realists are not opposed to cooperation among countries and even long-term relations of cooperation when interests are aligned. If you're a realist and you think the world is a really dog-eat-dog place, then having allies that are useful to you is something you'd want. Similarly, institutions are seen by realists not as a threat to American autonomy, but rather as tools that powerful states can use to advance their goals in a variety of ways. And finally, when you sort of see then how he goes out and tries to conduct foreign policy, it's not what a realist would really call for. You know, if you really think China is the problem, and he does, and there I would agree with him, you wouldn't tear up the Trans-Pacific Partnership on your third day in office and do all sorts of things designed to annoy, anger, upset allies in Asia and elsewhere if what you really want over time is some sustained cooperation with other countries. Similarly, if you're a good realist, I don't think you would have torn up the Iran nuclear deal the way he did without having anything to replace it with. So again, I'm hoping that he's not seen as much of a realist. Obama, in a funny way, was, I think, instinctively more of a realist. The problem is he was about the only one in his entire administration, with the possible exception of Ben Rhodes, but I'm not even sure about that.
Either is Ben Rhodes, I think. Ed, the subtitle of Steve's book, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy, brings to mind a little bit your last book on the decline of Western liberalism. And I'm just wondering to what extent you've thought about the connection or perhaps the culpability of America's foreign policy elite and this decline of liberalism that you wrote about.
That's a very good question. I think from the reviews I've read in Steve's book, and I do intend to read the whole thing, and also Steve's summary just now, I would cautiously share Steve's worldview that our foreign policy elites, and particularly in terms of Western elites, the American and British ones, after the Cold War, sort of fell prey to a triumphalism that then turned the values sort of based nature of our foreign policy into a parody of itself and created a culture of conformity, a punishment to those who strayed too far from the conformist line, which was essentially subscribing to the American exceptionalist view of the world. And I think the American exceptionalist view of the world is okay in moderation, but when it becomes a mentality of we've got nothing to learn from anybody else, we don't really need to understand our allies or our adversaries or those in between, we need them to understand what works, which is, you know, a caricature, but not a gross caricature, of the kind of mentality we saw emerging in the triumphalism of the post-Cold War era, of the unipolar era of the 90s, then I think it becomes profoundly counterproductive. It creates resentments. It leads to misreadings. It leads to foreign policy blunders, small and large. And I think that that has played a role, particularly in the way we've misread China this century. That has played a role in, I think, accelerating the sort of degradation of our model of our soft power as something that others strive to emulate and envy and think is worth aspiring to. I think that's no longer nearly as true as it was, and that I would say was the case before Trump was elected. It's certainly a lot worse now, but it was the case before Trump was elected. But I also think it's helped accelerate the shift of relative power geopolitically from west to east, and which is hard power too. So broadly speaking, I would agree with Steve's thesis, and I think the decline of the West and the decline of America has been exacerbated, would have been happening anyway and in relative terms, but has been exacerbated and turned into something far worse by our own blunders. And those blunders are very much linked to a groupthink, self-admiration in our foreign policy.
If I could jump in there, that was very lucid, Ed. There's always been this sort of interesting tension between this idea of American exceptionalism, because certainly in the unipolar era, on the one hand, we saw ourselves as exceptional and the indispensable power, but we also saw ourselves as an irresistible model. Somehow we're very special, but the rest of the world is going to want to become like us, and that's going to be easy to do. I mean, there was this real sense that you could spread democracy into lots of other places on the cheap. The way George W. Bush thought it would be possible, and even I think the way Bill Clinton thought it would be possible. I think, you know, now we look back and it almost seems delusional that we could have transformed Iraq into a fully functioning liberal democracy, or Afghanistan, or any number of other candidates. But there was always this tension, which I think Ed referred to, in the American image of itself as special. But on the other hand, the idea that we were also an irresistible or a seductive model. He's absolutely right, of course. This had enormous consequences for us just in terms of the amount of money that was squandered in various places. And I think finally, we just also forgot about great power politics, that no matter how much we believed that what we were doing was not hostile to others, was not directed at Russia, not directed at China, not directed at others. The point was not what we thought. The point was what they thought. And they saw this very revisionist strategy of ours, this effort to transform the world in America's image, as very dangerous. And of course, they reacted accordingly in a variety of different places.
So, Rosa, let me ask you a question. Everything that Steve has said thus far is compelling, as have been the comments of both Corey and Ed. And so the only conclusion I can reach is that the American foreign policy elite has declined while we were the American foreign policy elite. I wonder how that makes you feel.
You think it was something I said? the minute they let me in the door, it all fell apart. Well, I was actually thinking as I was listening to Steve, and I was wondering several things, which I'm not sure they're actually right, but I'll tell you what the thoughts that were running through my head. You know, one was that part of our problem, it strikes me, has been a sort of profound failure of the imagination. And I think that that has perhaps always been an American failing, that we are unable to imagine how we look and how the world looks through the eyes of others. And in particular, I think we are consistently unable to fully grasp that others are care as much about their nations or their group, whatever their group may be, as we care about ours. And so we consistently underestimate nationalism as a force in other countries, for instance, whether that as well as various forms of sort of subnational politics and tribalism, you know, that whether it's Vietnam in the late 1960s, early 1970s, or whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq more recently, that we have a lot of trouble just sort of wrapping our minds around the idea that what is obvious and appealing and attractive to us isn't necessarily obvious and appealing and attractive to other people, and that things that to us seem, you know, bizarre and inexplicable, why would you want to do that, can in fact have powerful pull to other people who have grown up with a different set of assumptions. And I wondered, you know, if that failure of imagination, that sort of failure, I mean, to some extent it's a failure of empathy, but it's also a sort of intellectual failure, a failure to be able to even briefly sort of inhabit the world views of other people and peoples, is there any connection between that failure of imagination and our own internal politics? You know, because I would, and this, here's where I sort of think, well, maybe I'm just, this may not actually make any sense, but I was thinking about debates about immigration and the ways in which we do and do not value diversity of experience and origins within our own country, and specifically within sort of the elite establishment of our own country. You know, that the more we look like one another and the more we surround ourselves by people who look and sound like us, the less we are forced in day-to-day life to exercise, you know, the empathy muscles and the imagination muscles, and the more we just end up reinforcing each other and you know, being unable to just grasp that not everybody thinks the way we do. And, you know, I certainly think it's accurate to say that the foreign policy establishment is extremely homogeneous. It's very white, you know, upper middle class, largely male still, getting somewhat less so, but it is still particularly at the top, largely male, you know, stems from the same, you know, 50 or so universities, exists in a geographically very limited part of the world, you know, inside the Beltway plus a few other cities and universities, and that can't be good.
Everything you said, you know, strikes me as absolutely true. But I find your notion that it stems from the same 50 universities to be.
You want to say five?
Five. Yeah.
Yep.
It's not.
It's a little broader, but okay. All right. Let's say 15.
Yeah. It's not that many. But you know, you bring up an important question, and I think it's obviously one you've grappled with throughout your career, Steve. And that is, did the American foreign policy elite have it right? You know, the sort of the general narrative is, at the end of the Second World War, the American foreign policy elite put the world back together, worked to establish a global order, worked to institutionalize the rule of law worldwide, had some vision, sought to hand off to the next generation the world in better shape than it was. And it's the baby boom, you know, elites who sort of inherited the world after the Cold War, who haven't been able to figure out what to do. And it's their failings, our failings, that are responsible for this. So we had it right once, and we don't have it right now. But maybe I have it wrong. What's your view of that?
Yeah, I think that you can actually make a pretty good case for that, but you have to add some caveats onto it. I mean, I think that the American foreign policy elite in the Cold War got most of the big things right. And in a funny way, it performed best at the beginning and the end. So the Truman administration actually did a remarkable job in uncertain, unfamiliar circumstances of putting together many of the sinews that that formed the Western Order and that essentially conducted the Cold War. And then there were some mistakes made along there, mostly in the developing world, of which Vietnam was the most obvious example. But again, we did get sort of the big things right, that the Soviet Union was the problem, that containment was the answer, that nailing down strong alliances in Europe and in Asia was the key to success. And then at the end, I think the Bush administration handling the breakup of the Soviet Union and the first Gulf War and the reunification of Germany, again, they didn't get everything right, but they got a lot of the big things right in the circumstances that were unfamiliar, uncertain as well. Since then, again, there are moments of success, but the record since then has really been quite disheartening. And I think Rose's comment earlier got it exactly right. There's a subheading in the book, actually, of one of the sections, which is when you're strong, you don't have to be smart. And I think that in some respects, it's not so much that baby boomers were idiots. It's rather that they were in a situation where the United States was so powerful, where we saw we could do anything. And if we got some things wrong, it really wouldn't be that bad, that you didn't have to be particularly intelligent. And you certainly, or careful, I guess is a better word. And you certainly didn't have to spend a whole lot of time empathizing with others, trying to understand their point of view, acknowledging that they might have a legitimate opinion or two. And this is why in this whole period, we tended to rely very much on coercion more than on diplomacy. To a first approximation, our foreign policy has been to figure out what we wanted other countries to do, tell them to do it, and if they didn't, then start ramping up the pressure. And that's not diplomacy. Diplomacy is about reaching compromises. It's about empathy. It's about figuring out what we want and then figuring out how to make somebody else want enough of that to go along with it. We've done that occasionally, but that has not been our standard practice for a long time. And I think it's largely an artifact of this extraordinary position we were in for so long.
I do want to note that you distanced yourself from baby boomers by saying they.
One of them.
Yeah. And you and I are 5 months apart in age, so I think we have to own up.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah. So Corey, one of the areas where, you know, the hell of good intentions has been most clearly on display throughout this entire period we've been talking about here is the Middle East. And it's been a place where we've miscalculated, we've overreached, we've allied ourselves with the wrong people. We've screwed up on almost every conceivable level. And when we've gotten things right, we undid it as quickly as possible afterwards. And I wonder to what extent you think that region is a good illustration of this thesis. Or is it perhaps an illustration of the fact that when the U.S. foreign policy elite was getting it right, it was dealing with simple, big issues. And when it started to come adrift, it was when it had to deal with every different corner of the world and every different set of problems, and it just could never have been up to that.
So I am always on jihad against the notion that there was a mythical time when the world was simple and foreign policy issues weren't thorny and complicated and hard to figure out. And I feel like if there's any place in the world that's an illustration of that, it would be the Middle East. I'm super eager to read Steve's book, and I'm sure I'll learn a lot from it. When I look at the Middle East, I certainly agree that the hubris of American choices in the Middle East from the end of the 91 Gulf War, right? So that was the last time we were modest enough and circumspect enough to limit the ends we were trying to achieve and to fully resource those ends and to make a reasonable judgment about what it was in our capacity to achieve. And as Steve said, to actually try and persuade others and make compromises in order to attain those ends. I was a coalition guy in Colin Powell's joint staff during the 1991 Gulf War. And we anguished about some of the trade-offs about putting that coalition together, but we understood the overarching political importance of people making meaningful contributions. And I saw none of that spirit of, well, we're going to have to make trade-offs if we expect people to feel to join in what we're trying to achieve. And we even have to make substantial trade-offs. Leave Saddam Hussein in power in 1991. But we understood we couldn't hold the coalition together if we maximized America's aims. And working defense issues in the White House in 2003, there was none of that kind of spirit of, wow, we better be careful not to bite off more than we can chew, or, wow, we better make important compromises with people who are going to live there forever. So I certainly agree that there were bad choices after 1991, after the end of the Cold War. I also agree with Steve that the first Bush administration, George H.W. Bush, was extraordinarily judicious about not overreaching at the end of the Cold War. But I do think the Eisenhower administration made bad choices in the Middle East. The Carter administration made bad choices in the Middle East. The Reagan administration made bad choices in the Middle East. I struggle to come up with an American president other than perhaps William Howard Taft, who did not make bad choices in the Middle East.
How do you feel about Thomas Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates?
I am pro Thomas Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates, Rosa. Thank you for asking.
You're welcome, Cor. I just wanted to make sure we didn't leave that out.
He didn't try to do nation building.
Yeah, exactly. Let me follow up with this with Ed. You know, when you sort of break this down, just taking the Middle East and as an example, there are a few reasons we could come a cropper, right? One is we misread the situation. In sort of an intellectual or a policy failure or an ideological failure with how do we approach foreign policy. Another is that we were co-opted for the wrong reasons. We were too caught up in oil, or we were too caught up in, you know, different kinds of special interest politics, or we were too caught up, as we've talked about in the last episode, in the money of the region, you know, and money pouring in and influencing the foreign policy elite. And another is there were no right answers. The place is just in such tumult. You know, we can't fix things that are that broke, and we can't really influence things that have that many moving parts. And I'm just wondering, as you look at it, are, you know, is it all of the above, or is does one of those things really leap out at you?
No, I think all foreign regions of the world that are not our own are complicated and require a deep study before, you know, daring to tread. And I think the Middle East is particularly so. For decades, we have therefore been particularly drawn like a moth to a flame to simple solutions, things that can just explain everything in one formula, you know, whether it's, you know, the exporting democracy via the Iraq invasion in 2003, that will fix everything, or whether it's at the far sort of more simplistic end of the spectrum, Jared Kushner thinking, Middle East is solvable. I found a guy. He's roughly my age. He's inherited a lot of money, too. You know, his dad helped him out. And he's just going to sort of help fix it for us. So this is the solution to the Middle East. The Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Is the temptation to find, to think that, but because it's a complicated lock, you've just got to find the key or the pick. And then you're through is even greater, precisely because the Middle East is so complicated. A corollary of that, which is not confined to Jared Kushner or Bolton or Trump, but which again they're worst exhibitors of, is the idea that Iran is the number one problem, and that essentially we've got to back the Sunni horse against the Shia devil. And that will be the sort of final battle that will break the forces of terrorism and you know, exporting instability around the region. It's another very, very dangerous siren song, which we're getting close to. I mean, I suspect the Khashoggi, the implications, escalating implications of the Khashoggi murder might sort of put a roadblock there. But ultimately, the sort of Bolton, Trump, Pompeo goal is to force some kind of confrontation with Iran. And again, it's for the same simplistic reasons of not understanding a region, of thinking you found, you know, the simple solution, and thereby sort of heading blindly into a solution that is dramatically worse than the problem, potentially in this case, another war of choice that is completely unnecessary.
Steve, do you have any reaction to that? I'm going to go to Rosa in a second, but I was just wondering what your thoughts were.
Well, I think that, I mean, certainly Corey is right. We've made mistakes in the Middle East for a long time, but I would argue most of them were relatively minor mistakes when you compare them to the ones we've made more recently. I mean, what Ed was just saying is exactly right. When you don't understand a region particularly well, the last thing you would want to do is the kind of ambitious social engineering we've been trying to attempt there, where we're going to take governments out and then provide them with some expert tutelage over how to create a different kind of government in societies we don't understand at all. This is immensely difficult. It's rife with unintended consequences, and the result is usually either a costly occupation or a failed state. Or both. That's why, you know, people like me argue that our policies in the Middle East should be first and foremost maintaining a balance of power there so nobody dominates, minimizing the American military footprint there, because that's a tremendous irritant and generates lots of anti-Americanism. And then going forward, instead of having special relationships with a handful of Middle East countries and no relationship whatsoever with some of the others, we should try to have normal relations with as many as possible, because, first of all, none of the countries in the Middle East deserve unconditional American support at this point. Saudi Arabia is the latest to line up and demonstrate why that's the case. And moreover, when American diplomats, you know, show up in Riyadh, I would like the Saudis to know that their next stop is Tehran. And when they get to Tehran, I want the Iranians to know that their next stop is Tel Aviv, after which they're going to Ankara. All right. That's how you maximize American leverage, because you're giving all of those countries an incentive to start doing things that will make America happy, as opposed to taking American support for granted and engaging in reckless behavior because they're so confident they've got Uncle Sam in their pocket.
Can I say something very quickly, just a quick sort of add on to what Steve's just said? I forgot to mention that, you know, the concept you're arguing for in your book and have just now of offshore balancing, if done well, is an extremely attractive one to simply prevent another power from dominating any of the other regions. And this is what Kissinger in his famous book Diplomacy, you know, extolled about British foreign policy before Britain became extremely bad at it, you know, in the 18th, 19th century, is simply to back the underdog to prevent one power from dominating the continent. That is a realist strategy, but all realism requires exactly the opposite of what Trump is. It requires detailed knowledge and empathy for the players with which you're dealing.
That's right.
And discipline.
And yes, and the first Gulf War, as Corey pointed out, the first Gulf War is a perfect illustration of offshore balancing. Iraq suddenly emerges as a serious challenge by seizing Kuwait, and the United States organizes a coalition to reverse that, to disarm Iraq, and then is smart enough not to try and remake Iraqi society.
Rosa, I wanted to turn to you on this, because What Steve was just laying out and Ed was emphasizing, and Corey did, was common sense, you know, and I think we have to talk them off the ledge. Common sense has no place in foreign policy. More seriously, one of the things that struck me while I was listening to Steve was there is a major power doing exactly what he's talking about, and that's China.
Yeah.
I mean, the way China is handling the Middle East is, you want to deal with us, deal with us. You want to do it, you know, for commercial reasons, or you want to do it for some other reasons, that's fine. But we're not going to set preconditions. And so, they're dealing with everybody.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to a couple of the things that Steve and others have said. On the one hand, in many ways, my sympathies are with the realists, particularly. I don't think they've always been with the realists. I think they have over time come to be with the realists, precisely as you know, I have seen how often our grandest ambitions have led to results that are worse, not only for us, but for others as well. That our grandiose efforts to remake other people's societies for them and improve them tend to backfire and cause an enormous amount of suffering for them as well as for us. But partly because I mean, here's the one area where I'm question mark for Steve, I guess. I'm not sure I'm entirely in sympathy. So, in hindsight, it was probably the absolute right move for George H.W. Bush to leave Saddam in place, creepy as he was. And it was the absolute wrong move for George W. Bush to compound the initial error of invading Iraq for no good reason, with the determination to entirely remake Iraqi society through de-bathification and the ouster of Saddam Hussein, and a more modest approach. Even if you accept the initial error of the invasion, a more modest approach might have been more effective both for the U.S. and less devastating, ultimately, for the Iraqi population. But it strikes me that one thing that we did after the first Gulf War, which was not so cool, in our effort to prevent any one regional power from gaining regional hegemony, was to, you know, actively work to keep the Iran-Iraq war going in a manner that would bankrupt and exhaust both of those players, keep them so busy fighting each other to the point of exhaustion that neither could cause too much trouble for us. And, you know, that was a devastating decision for the people of the region, right? And so in a way, I'm just asking the same old question that you know, everyone lobs at realists, which is, you know, wait a second, realist from whose perspective, and what about human rights, and what about, you know, what if our success comes at the very distinct expense of other populations? You know, how do we make sense of that? You know, is this a sort of realist approach to achieving international security, or is this just a realist approach to carrying on U.S. Prosperity and dominance for as long as possible? Because if it's the first, that maybe pushes us in a different direction than if it's the second.
We've just got about 2-3 minutes here, Steve.
Okay. Well, I'll be very quick then. That's a great question. And I would feel guilty, I guess, or feel uncomfortable if I thought I was being sort of a completely amoral, you know, it's only what's good for the United States, and that's all that really matters. I mean, needless to say, I do think a more modest foreign policy would be much better for the United States. But I think the record of the past quarter century suggests it would also be better for many parts of the world where, again, with good intentions, we've caused a considerable amount of harm and haven't really fessed up to it. There's also, it seems to me, a difference between what I believe we were doing during the Iran-Iraq war, which was basically making sure that nobody won, but we weren't necessarily the ones pouring the gasoline on it to keep it going. Iran and Iraq, Iran in particular, really did not want to get out of that war until Khomeini finally realized that they just couldn't win and they had to do it. It seems to me, what we should have then continued, namely, let these two countries that don't seem to like each other very much continue to check each other, rather than what we did in the Clinton administration, which was to institute dual containment and say, we, the United States, will actually contain both of them simultaneously, which led to a whole series of other problems. Last point, I make it clear in the book, we should be open to using our power in humanitarian cases to prevent genocides, to prevent mass killings. But I set the bar pretty high there, that it has to be a situation where we really think there's a danger, there's something we can do about it, and very importantly, we're not going to make things worse.
folks out there in deep state radio land, you listen to these episodes. This is about our 140th episode, and I know you've heard them all. And when you hear everybody in our group as engaged in a subject as they just have been, you know that it's an important and timely subject. And that's why Steve's book, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite and the Decline of U.S. Primacy, is so timely, and why, of all the audiences in the world I can possibly imagine for this book, outside of Steve's own students who are undoubtedly obligated to buy it, and his family, presumably family.
It's sweet you think students buy books, David.
Yeah, no, well, it's, well, that's a good point, actually. I haven't been teaching a class for a year, so I've forgotten some of that. But I think for those of you out there listening to this podcast, this is exactly the kind of book that you want to read, and maybe the kind of book that the Deep State Radio Book Club wants to go and follow in one of its future editions. We're going to have this same great gang of people back for the next episode to talk about what's going on in the world, the Khashoggi thing and the INF and a whole host of other recent developments. So please join us again in a couple of days for that, unless you're a Deep State Radio Network member, in which case you can join us right now for that because you get all the podcasts together. We hope you'll join because one of the things that allows us to do what we do here at Deep State Radio Network is your memberships, and that allows us to be ad-free and to be independent. So sign up and join us for this and all the other new content we've got. And in the meantime, thank you, Steve. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, Ed. Thank you, Rosa. Thank you, everybody. And join us again on the next Deep State Radio.
Deep State Radio is a production of the Deep State Radio Network, a division of TRG Interactive Media. Our podcast today was produced in cooperation with Goat Rodeo Productions and was supervised by Ian Enright. Join us again for another episode of Deep State Radio. If you don't, we know where to find you.